This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Well, we've finished the creation. Or are we? Is there anything that hasn't yet been created? Do you remember we were studying the creation? See the sea of blank faces, creation. What was created, not created?
It was from the first day and then a little bit on the sixth day.
Is there anything that has not yet evolved? Woman. Woman. No women. Imagine what a world that was. No women. And yet, we were told that man was created male and female, and God blessed him and said, be fruitful and multiply. So not only was it a world without women, it was a world that had no need for women. Man was the only species that could multiply without a mate. Women had not been created, but multiplication was possible. Progenation was possible. And yet the story goes on. And although this is told after the Shabbos break, after the seven days of creation, it's made very clear to us that the story of chapter 2, at least not only the first part, the whole of chapter 2, took place before Shabbat, on the Friday still. And so we're moving back in time and examining a process that in much greater detail than it was first reported. And in fact, the Gemara says, and the Medrash brings it several times, that the Asoro Ma'amoris Nivra Ha'olam, Pirkei Avos says it, the world was created with 10 statements. God said, it says Vayomer, and God said 10 times. Now if you count them, there aren't 10. If you count them, there are only 8. Well, we count Bereshis as one of them. In the beginning God created, although it doesn't say, and God said, let there be heaven and earth, we regard that as one of the statements. That's how God creates. He creates with statement. He creates with the expression of his voice and of his intent. And so when it says in the beginning God created, that was one of the statements. That gives us 9. Where's the 10th? And according to one view in the Medrash, the 10th is, Vayomer Hashem Elokim, and Hashem, God said, Lo tov heyoso adam levado. It is not good for man to be alone. That was also a statement of creation. The creation of aloneness as an unacceptable state was in itself a creation. The creation of the need for companionship. Not the need for procreation. Not the need to be able to have children and to regenerate. That was in place already. There wasn't that need. Each time that God said, each time it says Vayomer, and God said, let there be, it was something else that the universe required. Let there be light, let there be sea, let there be dry land, let there be animals, let there be birds. Each one was something the world needed. What's important to understand is that the introduction of woman as an independent being was subsequent to the human being's capacity to procreate. And therefore the man-woman relationship is not designed for procreation. It's designed for something else. Procreation was possible without it. And it's in that understanding of these opening passages that we differ from, for example, the Catholic Church, and where they get themselves into such difficult hot water and don't know quite how to get out of it. On issues such as contraception, for example. As far as we're concerned, the husband-wife relationship has a whole reason for existence other than having children. As important as having children is, there is a reason for existence other than having children. That's not the reason for marriage. That's not the only reason for marriage. Man was able to procreate before woman was created. And that's how we understand the introduction of woman's role into the world. So the question is, what was she created for then? What was that need? In what way was man deficient? Adam was created with this brilliant intellect, the capacity to understand, perceive, have insight into everything that ever was and ever would be. He was able to procreate. He was created by God himself. He was able to create intellectually. He was the most brilliant being that was ever created, the purest, most holy being that was ever created. What was he lacking? What was the need to bring woman in? And that's what we'll study this evening. Now there's a further difficulty, and that is that we learned at the end of the last year that God doesn't satisfy a need until the lack is recognized, and that's part of the reason for prayer. That as much as we might need something, and as much as God might want to give it to us and be ready to give it to us, until we notice that we don't have it, we're conscious of the lack, God will very often not satisfy that need. And so he might have enormous blessing waiting for us, and he might be saying, this is all here, but you're not going to get it until you notice you need it. So God did not bring rain into the world, you'll remember, until man was created to work the world. So during the first 6 days of creation, until man enters the scene, there was no rain. Everything was ready to grow, there just wasn't rain. Why wasn't there rain? Because there was nobody to appreciate rain. And God wasn't going to bring into the world something so blessed and so powerful as water until the human being understood the need for water, prayed for water, and thanked God for water. And if God was to bring in companionship, this is now the second thing God is creating for man. Everything else was created before man. For man, God created rain, that came afterwards, and God created woman. To create rain, to create in man a recognition of the need for rain was not that difficult. They put man in the garden, and soon things start withering, and things don't start growing. And he digs around in the ground a little bit, and he sees little roots, and he sees little bulbs trying to grow. And it's not very difficult for him to notice that they're drying out, and that their moisture needs to be replenished, and where's the water? Oh, ask God, the water will come. So man can be brought to an understanding of the lack, of the absence of rain. But how do you bring a man who has never experienced companionship, nor seen it secondhand, nor read about it, nor studied it, nor seen it in any form, how do you bring him to understand the absence of companionship? Very difficult. There's some bachelors that have seen it and that have heard about it and that have read it, and they still don't understand the absence of companionship. But Adam had absolutely no capacity to understand what that meant in an experiential way. Enough to be able to pray to Hashem and to say, I need companionship. And if we look at the Torah, that begins to make sense of what would otherwise be a very difficult passage where God says, Lo tov heyoso adam levado. It is not good for man to be alone. E'ese lo ezer kenegdo. I shall make for him an ezer kenegdo. Strange term, and we'll explain it during this evening's shir. An ezer, a help, a companion opposite him. And then, it doesn't say, and so God created a woman. It says, it tells us the story again, that God created all the animals of the field and all the birds of this heaven. Vayove el ha'odom, and he brought all the species, every animal, every bird, before Adam, liros mayikroloi, to see how Adam would classify them. How would Adam, what would Adam call them? V'cholashe yikroloi ha'odom nefesh chayo hushumo. And any living being that Adam gave a name to would retain that name. So what's this got to do with it all of a sudden? God says man shouldn't be alone, and then he brings the whole animal world to Adam to see what he would call him. V'yikro ha'odom shemes l'chol ha'behemo ul'oif ha'shumayim. Adam studies every single animal, every single bird, and he names every single one of them accurately, specifically. Ulo Adam lo imotso ezer kenegdo. But for Adam, he couldn't find a wife. Big surprise. Looked at the birds, and he looked at the locusts, and he looked at the monkeys, and he looked at the lions, and he looked at the antelope, and he looked at the mice, and he looked at the rats, and he didn't find a wife. Isn't that strange? Didn't find a wife. What did God expect him to find a wife there? Was that the purpose of that exercise? And it also doesn't say, and he didn't find a wife for himself. It says, Ula Adam, and for man. he found no companion. But clearly what God wanted him to do was to see the companionship that existed in the animal world, to see the mating system in the animal world, to see how animals procreated as opposed to the human being at that stage. The human being could procreate without companionship, but in the animal world there was at least some kind of twosomeness which was lacking in the human world, which brought Adam to have some deeper understanding of it. But the Ramban goes further than that and says the following: Hashemos, the names that Adam gave were not names specific to each animal, but he havdolas haminim, he categorized them into what's the Latin term? Genuses, isn't that right? Species, each one with a family, genus, isn't that right? Each one with a family. That's what he was doing. He wasn't just calling monkeys and apes and rats and mice. He was categorizing them, saying this is one species, this is another species, these animals belong together, these animals belong together. And how do you do it? What did he use? What was his mechanism for classifying? Well, says the Ramban, ki ovru lefonov zachor nekevo, he studied the masculine and the male and female of each type of animal, of each individual animal, v'hisboinein betivom, and he analyzed the nature of all of them to understand eze mehem ezel zel ze betoldos betolodos shiyulidu ze mize, which could conceivably mate and create a new, possibly even a new species. In other words, not only the particular animal with the female of that particular animal, but what he analyzed also was how far could crossbreeding take place? At what point would it fail? And anywhere where crossbreeding could theoretically take place, he regarded as one species, understanding that the species cannot breed across one another. So you can take a lion and a tiger as they once did, and you can make a liger. But you cannot take a lion and an antelope and make a lantelope. That won't happen. Different species. There's no way that they can crossbreed. And Adam was able to take all of zoology, the entire world of zoological species, and work out which categories could theoretically interbreed and which categories could not theoretically interbreed. And he found in each species there were probably hundreds of individuals. Tens of individual animals that fitted into a specific species that could not only breed with themselves, but could theoretically breed across the individuals within that species, within that family. Beloy motzo bekulon shetiyo betivo ezeloy. And he found that the human being himself was the only example of that species. That's what he discovered. That the human being is not one member of a larger group. He discovered what Darwin tried to undo thousands of years later, to claim that the human being is just a more sophisticated version of another species. No, says Odom, don't ever think that, because any simple zoologist knows that part of the definition of a species is the incapacity of that species to be bred with any other species. And if you define a species in that way, then the human being is not capable of creating a second generation from any other mate in the whole world of zoology. Which is very, very strange. I think now with the genetic study that they've just done with the human genome, what did they find? That the difference between us and a mouse in genes, about 7 genes or something, is that right? It's minute, the difference. And it's not that much bigger than the difference between any other two animals, which would seem to support some kind of theory of evolution, that we're just more sophisticated animals. Little gene here, little gene there, no big deal, just a little bit of chemical differences. I remember years ago, I was a kid, I was going to yeshiva, and for some things my father was very punctual, and for some things he was very not punctual. The one thing that he was not punctual about was getting us to the airport when we had to leave and go to yeshiva. For that he always used to drive very fast, but when we were going to the airport to catch a plane to go to yeshiva, one of the kids, He would drive so slowly and talk, and if you check this and don't forget that. And it happened more than once that we missed planes. And one time, it was a time that I didn't miss a plane. They were holding it for me, and I ran on, and it was terribly embarrassing. I walked on, and everybody started clapping and booing, and I was the last one on. It was terrible. And I sat down next to a man, and he said to me, "You're going to pay for this." So I said, "Well, what am I going to pay?" He said, "We're going to have a discussion, and if I win, you're going to buy me a drink, and if you win, I'll buy you a drink." So I said, "Fine." And the discussion started, and the issue was evolution and religion and all of that. And I was tired, and I was traumatized, and leaving home and going off to yeshiva. And the last thing I wanted to do was to sit and argue with this person about evolution. And it wasn't even evolution, it was why Jews don't marry Gentiles, and it's the same species, and why should we remain separate, and it's only one species, and there's no difference. And we're arguing and arguing, and eventually he keeps his trump card till the end, and he says, "Okay, here comes my free drink." He says, "If you analyzed the reproductive cell of a Jew and a Gentile genetically, do you think you would find any difference?" And my answer was, "You analyze the reproductive cell of yourself and a donkey, you probably wouldn't find a difference either." Which probably isn't true, but the differences are minute. But the differences are very, very minute. That's not what makes us different species. What makes us different species is we can't interbreed. That's the definition that Adam gave us right in the beginning of a species. And with that definition of species, which is quite scientific, the human being is a different species, totally different, who has no partner, no possibility of partner. There's something totally unique about us. There are parts of us that are similar. There are parts of us that may well have evolved. But those little genes that make us different are pretty important genes. Because with those genes, we can do what no other animal can do. And those genes are responsible for the fact that we cannot interbreed with others. And at that moment, Adam is overcome with this enormous sense of loneliness. As long as he thought somewhere in the world there might be someone, somewhere in the world there might be another human being. Look at humanity, how it's struggling to find life on another planet. Never, how desperate we must be to try and find. Maybe there's another human life out there somewhere. Maybe there's somebody. We're sending out messages there. Maybe somebody will hear it in years to come and say, "Oh, intelligent life somewhere else as well." Trying to find somebody else like us. We're so desperate not to be unique. Adam suddenly finds there's enormous loneliness in uniqueness. After the study of the entire world of zoology, Adam suddenly realizes there's not another human being. There's not another being that is even from the same species as I am. Don't you sometimes feel that when you walk around among people? So what does he do? And what does he mean that there isn't another of the same species? And he doesn't find an Ezer Kenegdo. Doesn't say he doesn't find a mate, an Ezer Kenegdo. There's certain unique aspects to the physiological man-woman relationship that are different from the animals. And they all revolve around the word kenegdo, that oppositeness. The one, says the Klei Yaakov, is the fact that only the human engages in sexual activity face to face. And that is symbolic of the inextricable role of love and emotion in that physical relationship. That this is not something only physiological, that the ability to communicate with one another, to communicate verbally during that moment, to be able to communicate facially, to be able to communicate with expression, to be able to send messages to one another other than a purely sexual message at that moment is something that is uniquely human. So when Adam studies how animals procreate, he realizes the gap. I can have children, says Adam, without any sexual activity. They can have children with pure sexual activity. But there's something in between an Ezer Kenegdo, and Odom begins to feel the lack. But there's something more in the Ezer Kenegdo that the Ramban deals with, and he says the following. Clearly, as we know, man and woman, man could procreate before this. So what is it that God wasn't satisfied when God says it's not good for man to be alone? It's not as if Adam was the one who discovered it. Adam wasn't the first one to say, it's not good for me to be alone. I can't stand this loneliness. God said it's not good for man to be alone. And God then put Adam into a situation where he too discovered it wasn't good to be alone. But had God not put him in that situation, he would have lived in ignorant bliss and thought it's fine to be alone. God engineers it that he sees that it's not good to be alone. Why does he do that? Why is God not satisfied with the way he originally created man? Sister Ramban, there's another interesting part to the togetherness that God wanted that was different from the togetherness that already existed. The togetherness that already existed was, it wasn't just that man was hermaphrodite, that he was one being that could procreate. It was more like a Siamese twin. There was a male and a female part that functioned like male and female, that was attached, and that they were as one being, and they served one another. Why wasn't that any good? It says the Rambam, V'ro'o HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and God saw, Ki tov shiyeh ha'ezer omed lenegdo. God wanted the ezer, the companion, to stand opposite him. V'hu yireno, so that he may see her, V'yiporeid mimeno, and withdraw from her, v'yishaber elof kefi ritzono, and come close to her as he chooses. God didn't want permanent attachment. He wanted the capacity for movement. Difficult, Ramban. Why is that so? There's a piece of D.H. Lawrence that explained this, Ramban. D.H. Lawrence, when I was a kid, it's one of those books in those days, it was about, particularly in South Africa, it was about as pornographic as one could get in terms of literature. So I used to buy D.H. Lawrence and sneak it into the house and read it, and I loved it. Lady Chatterley's Lover was not available in South Africa. The other books were available. And one day we were sitting at the table and my father says to me, I saw your notes in D.H. Lawrence's essays. My goodness, where did I leave this book lying around? And he said, and he referred to this particular essay, and I had noted on that essay, look at this Ramban. Because he says there in just a few lines, and I don't have it here, but very, very simply and very beautifully, he says that love is a tide, and there is a flow and there is an ebb. It is a coming together, but there can be no coming together without a drawing asunder. Love is not a coming together and that's it. Oh, mazel tov, we're now together. And then what? The next moment of love is when you come together again. But for that, there has to be a pulling apart. So when God says, I want the Ezer to be kenegdo, so that, as the Ramban explains, they can pull apart and draw together again and create a rhythm of coming and going, of tide and ebb. If the creation of that is in fact the creation of a sustainable love between the same two partners. In the absence of that, the love is not sustainable. In the absence of that, there is a stagnancy that sets in, there is a taking for granted that sets in, and the love is not sustainable. Built around this concept are two important laws in the Torah. Once again, pretty unique to our religion. The one is the laws of family purity. That there is built into the marriage process a tide and an ebb. There's built a rhythm is built in to institutionalize the moving and the coming and the moving and the coming. And it's tied in with the rhythm of a woman's body so that that becomes natural, so that it becomes real, that there's a tuning into it. And the other important law that revolves around this is the capacity for divorce. The fact that is that marriage can never be taken for granted. That the Catholic concept of a marriage which in theory can't be broken is a marriage doomed to boredom, doomed to stagnancy. It is the capacity of the partners to choose not to live together that creates the imperative for them to continue working on coming together, because that is work that needs investment, and if that doesn't take place, there is no coming together. So explains the Ramban, what God wants is not a man and a woman bound together like Siamese twins. God wants to separate them and put them in a situation where their coming together is a daily choice. Every single day it's a choice. Does a woman want to be with a man just because he has no out? Does a man want to be with a woman just because she has no out? That shouldn't be the basis of it. The basis of it should be, there's the door. You want to go? Goodbye. But who would want to go? Who would want to leave a person like me? Because of the way I work in it. And if both are working on that basis, if both are working on the fact that where else would you find somebody working on a marriage the way I'm working, working on a marriage the way you're working, that's the marriage that the Ribbono Shel Olam wants. But he separates man and woman from being an inseparable unit into being two separable beings, requiring them to constantly choose to come together, to see one another, notice one another, look at one another, and will to be together on a day-to-day basis. We'll see the impact of that. And when Adam studies the animal world, he sees again the two extremes. In my situation, says Adam, I'm inseparable from my wife. She's part of me, she's bound to me, we're Siamese twins. In the animal world, there is no togetherness. They come together for procreation and they disappear. Where's the balance? Isn't it possible to find a relationship where there is permanence, but the permanence is the function not of a biological connection, but of two people's willing choice, exercised over and over again every single day? That's what I want. That's security. Security is not being bound, and security is not being free. Security is being bound by one's own choice on a constant basis. Security is willing and allowing oneself to be enticed into marriage over and over again every single day of that marriage. That's what security is in a human sense. And Adam doesn't find that. He doesn't find it in the animal world, and he doesn't find it in his own world. At that point, God says, you're ready. You're ready for a wife. And so he creates an Ezer Kenegdo. The word kenegdo, another interesting thing about kenegdo. It's interesting how in this one word of the Torah, kenegdo, lies the whole differentiation of the human mating system, of what a man-woman relationship is and in what way it's different from anything else that exists in the universe. The other important word noting in kenegdo is the following. The Sipurna says, negdo means opposite him. And he says, imagine a balance, a scale. When they're opposite one another, the only time they're opposite one another is when they're equally weighted. And so, man and woman were created as an Ezer Kenegdo, as another being equal to him. There is total equality. Well, almost. It doesn't say Ezer Negdo. It doesn't say as a help opposite him, on the same level. It says Kenegdo. Almost opposite him. Almost, not quite. What does that mean? Says the Sipurna. Or he doesn't say, but I want to reread to you a few lines from the Menorah Samor that we have done before, I think in the Shir. Where he brings a case from the Medrash. The notes, they don't know where the origin of this medrash is, but the Menorah Samor is an extremely reliable source and quoted as a medrash. Shetzivso chachomo achas levito kishehoiso melicho lebeis baila. That a wise woman advised her daughter on the way to the chuppah. Amra lo, she said, Biti, my daughter, imdi lefonov kilifnei hamelech. Stand before him as if you're standing before a king. Utishatehu, and serve him. Ve'imtihi yiloi amo, and if you will truly be a servant to him, a maidservant to him, hu yihye loch eved, he will be your slave. Vichabdech kigeviro, and he will honor you like a mistress. v'im tisgad li olav. But if you prefer to lord it over him, yihyeh lach la'odon bal korchech, he will by force be your master. V'az tihyeh be'enov niklo ka'achas ha'shefoches, and then you in his eyes will be cheaper than one of the servant girls, is the advice that she gives her. Is that politically correct? Of course not. Totally politically incorrect. But it's true. And she advises her, there can't be two on the same level. Anybody who runs a company knows that. Every attempt at joint chief executives, and joint chairmen have never, ever worked, and couldn't possibly work. There has to be a separation at the end of the day. An individual has to be responsible. And therefore, apart from that, the male ego, all sorts of things that come into play. If you want to be treated as the queen, act like the maidservant. Unbelievable concept. Counterintuitive. Reverse psychology. It's absurd, but that's how it works. And if you want to act like the queen, you'll be treated like the maidservant. So says the Sipurna, kenegdo. Don't see yourself exactly equal to him. A fraction of a millimeter. See yourself as a fraction of a millimeter less, so that you can elevate him and his male ego can play its role and the relationship can function as it needs to function. Now, that we're not going to go into that in great detail, although we have before and we can at another time. I'm not afraid to go into it in great detail. But the need to understand that the level, and when we're talking about, and that's how the Sipurna puts it, a fraction, just a fraction of a millimeter, there isn't probably another society or culture, certainly until very, very recently, that has put women at that level of equality in terms of a male-female relationship. So don't focus on the fraction of the millimeter, focus on the rest of it in terms of understanding the principle. Kenegdo, not negdo, but kenegdo. Let's look at another few strange pieces of wording here to understand it even better. So man now understands the need for a ezer kenegdo, a companion who is separate from him, who can withdraw from him, from whom he can withdraw, who can come together with him, who's face to face with him, and therefore there's intimacy and companionship, not just physiology, but there's true intimacy and communication at all times. And it's kenegdo, she's equal to him, just about, from his perspective equal, from hers just a little bit less. From his perspective, it's not equal, in fact. From his perspective, she's the superior one. From his perspective, she treats him, he treats her, kigaviro, like the mistress, like the mistress in the sense of she who masters the home, she who is the powerful one in that relationship. And we'll see the sense of power. In fact, in understanding the sense of her power, the Klei Yochor, just before we move on to the other difficult wording, says a very strange thing, which I was debating whether to raise with you or not. But once we're here, really, we might as well just do it. What does it mean it is not good for man to be alone? It doesn't say it's not healthy for man to be alone, or it's not pleasant for man to be alone. He said it's not good. Why? Because he says, basically, if man does good without the challenge of the desire to do wrong, then what's the value of the good? If there's no resistance, there's no value to the exercise. And so if there's no moral resistance to doing good, then there is no value to that good. So let's create women to create moral resistance to doing good. That's what the Klei Yochor says. And the Klei Yochor was philosophically and psychologically very advanced and very modern. It's not the kind of thing he would normally say, but that's what he says. And what does that mean? That means that if woman would not have been created, man probably would not have sinned. And we know that's true in terms of the first sin. Woman wasn't in the picture. The snake wasn't in the picture. Woman wasn't in the picture. If Adam and Chava, if man and woman were still linked as Siamese twins, there wouldn't have been sin. So the fact is, the Kayaka is probably right, that the creation of woman as a separate entity we see led to sin, but the Kayaka is more than that. God sets it up that way and says, because without woman, there is no challenge to morality. The challenge to morality is through woman. Why? And we know the Gemara says over and over again, and right here the Medrash comments of the value of the woman and the value of a woman in a relationship, and that without a woman there's no blessing and there's no joy and there's no sanctity. We know what a woman brings into a relationship. How can the Kli Yoker position her as if she's the devil incarnate? And the way we need to understand that is that the woman has the capacity, more than probably the only being that has that capacity, to intrigue the man to such a degree that she is able to attract him and distract him from almost anything. And that is her power. If she uses that for good, she can motivate her man to achieve the most sublime activities. If she uses that for negativity, the chances are he doesn't stand a chance. The chances are he cannot stand up to that if she knows how to use it effectively. And so by creating in woman and in femininity that capacity to attract, that capacity to intrigue, is so powerful that in it lies the potential for man to be led astray in all sorts of different ways. Whatever she might want, whatever she might direct, is something which in theory she could get him to do. So when we say that she's only a little less than man, yes, in some ways. At the end of the day, he might be the one who has the authority vested in him by the Torah, kind of. But if it's a question of getting him to want to do something, there's nobody that can do that more effectively than a woman. And that's the power God gave the woman. And that's their equality. That's the built-in equality. Now if we take it a little further and see where all this leads, God then puts Adam to sleep and operates on him. Vayapel Hashem Elokim Tadeh Emal Adam, puts him to sleep. Vayishon, he goes to sleep. Vayikach Achas Mitzaloisov, and he took one of his sides, not one of his ribs. Man still has all his ribs. He took one of his sides, meaning that feminine side that was built into him. Vayiskor Boso Tachteno, he closes up the flesh again and builds the side into an independent being called a woman. Asks the Medrash, Matruna achas shailo es Rabbi Yossi. A certain woman came to Rabbi Yossi with a shailah. Imagine the shailahs in those days. It's interesting. Today, if a woman phones with a shailah, it's usually to know whether the ice cream's kosher or it's not kosher. Omalu, she said, Lomo bigneva, I want to ask you a shailah in the second chapter of Bereshis. Why did God have to steal his side away? Put him to sleep and then take it? And then he would wake up and it was just done? Why does it have to be with such deception? Says Rabbi Yossi, you call this theft? If a man takes away a measure of silver from you and brings back 10 times as much in gold, would you call that theft? He took away a bit of skin and he brought back a woman. Who would object to that? So she says, alright, so it's not theft. But it was the matmunius. It was in hiding. It was secretly. Why did he have to do it secretly? Why didn't God allow man to participate in this wondrous creation of woman? Why didn't he get the special effects and see the whole thing happening in front of his eyes and see this woman forming slowly? Imagine what a sight that would have been for him to behold. Answers Rabbi Yossi, you're right. Bitchilo bera'olo vera'o yiso. God tried that already. He actually created a woman twice. He created her once and allowed Adam to participate as a spectator in that act of creation. And when man saw her being put together with all her veins and her sinews and how her muscles were all connected before the skin was on top and the blood all over the place, he said, yuck, don't want her. So this time, God puts him to sleep and produces a woman and dresses her up and decorates her with the medrashes further on, 10 different types of beautiful decorations, and brings her to him in all her glory. And Adam says, in fact, in the very words of the Torah, Zos hapam, this time, this is a piece of my own flesh, this I will call a woman. Zos hapam, meaning this time I accept her. The first one you brought to me I didn't want. Amra loy, this woman said to Rabbi Yossi, Mesefes ani advarecha, you're absolutely right, I've never understood this before. Amuro ayisi lihinose la'achi imi, I was destined to marry the brother of my mother. I was supposed to marry my uncle. But because we grew up together as children, I was unattractive to him. So he got married to somebody else. And believe me, says this woman, she's nothing like me as beautiful. She didn't marry anybody more beautiful. She's ugly. Nothing like me. I was much more attractive. Everybody knew that. But he found me ugly. So beauty is not something that can be objectively measured. Now this marriage is interesting altogether. What about Bashirt? She says, I was his Bashirt. He married somebody else. One can marry somebody who's not one's Bashirt. And why? Because I wasn't presented to him as a finished product. He saw me in the raw. He saw me in the making. And so I was like a sister to him. I was like one of his kid friends, brothers, sisters. There wasn't the same attractiveness. And so we see in the way God creates Chava and brings her to Adam complete and decorated, how fragile is that crucial element called beauty, attractiveness, whatever it is. That power that God has given to women, with which to dominate man, is incredibly fragile, and she can ruin it so easily by allowing it to become something taken for granted and something that he sees as an evolving process rather as a continually changing process and something totally unpredictable. And so they get together. Man calls her Isha, a woman. And the Torah then says, Al kein therefore, Ya'azov ishes ovives imoy, a man shall leave his mother and his father and his mother, v'dovak be'ishtoy, and cleave to his wife, v'hoyu levosor echad, and they shall be as one flesh. And we learned this piece 3 years ago in this shir, and we talked about the view of Rashi, that means that they form one flesh in the creation of a child. Husband and wife create one flesh, one being, and that's the child, and in that is expressed their intimacy. The Ramban questions that and says animals have that too. Animals also create one flesh out of their coming together. And clearly what the Torah says here is unique to the human being. It leaves the father and mother, cleaves to his wife, and becomes one being. And therefore the Ramban says this is not just in the terms of the creation of a child. But rather because when a man and a woman create a unity, they form a unity, they become like one, and he craves to be with her always. That's what's unique about the human condition. The animal doesn't crave a togetherness, the human being does crave a togetherness, which links into what the Ramban said earlier, that what creates that togetherness is their desire to be together, their craving to be together, that continuous wanting to come together. The Chashio Yozeh Ba'odom, and since this was in the first man, Husom Tivo Batol, those of it became part of human nature. The Yoyos Hazachori Mehim, Devekim Bin Hoshoseim, Ozim Es Avim Ves Imom, that the male of the species leaves the father and mother, or those who functional do, and cleave to wives and become one with their wives. Veroyin es nishusehim ki ilu hein imam lebosur echod, and they feel an intimacy with their wives that is virtually the creation of a single being. And I want to end with, Medrash tells the following story. Another meaning of Ezer Kenegda. Ezer im Zocho, if the man is fortunate, Ezer, there's companionship. Be in love, and if he's not, Kenegdo, she fights him. There's tension. Im Zocho, what does that mean? If he's lucky, Ki Ishto Shu Rabbi Chanino ben Chachino, he'll have a wife like Rabbi Chanino ben Chachino. What was so special about her? Rabbi Chanino was once delayed in the Beis HaMedrash. She was went to David Ma'ariv, and he carried on afterwards. There was learning going on, and he was delayed. How long do you think he was delayed? It wasn't just an hour or two. It was 12 years before he made it home. He got involved in learning, and he couldn't tear himself away. Not like Rabbi Akiva, whose wife said, go and study. This guy's wife didn't know where he was. The last she heard, he was going to David Ma'ariv. 12 years later, he comes home. Can you imagine what a woman would say 12 years later? I've been waiting for you. An hour late, there's already a mouthful. 12 years! Nothing. She understood. He was studying where he was, becoming great, and that was fine with her. So that's, you know, if that's the kind of relationship that you want, then that's what you would have. But in love, if you're not lucky, then ki ishto shu Rabbi Yossi Haglili, you could land up chas v'sholom with a wife like Rabbi Yossi, like Mrs. Rabbi Yossi Haglili. What was so bad about her? Listen, it's interesting how open the Medrash is. It doesn't try and hide these things. These are facts of life. We have to realize from the suffering, the problems, and learn from these things, just as we do from the glorious stories. It's interesting, you will never read a story like this, I don't think, in one of the art scroll stories about the Gedolim. You'll just hear how wonderful all the marriages were, and how she was an angel and he was an angel, and their children were angels and everybody was angels. That's what you'll read about. That's why they're like the New Testament. Just like the New Testament. Everything is perfect. Absolutely perfect. But the Medrash isn't like that. The Torah isn't like that. The Torah we learn from life, and life has problems, and life has joys, and life has sadness. We learn from it all. Listen to the story. Rabbi Yossi Havale Intato Bisha, Rabbi Yossi Haglili, the great Rabbi Yossi Haglili, one of the pillars of the Mishnah, had a terrible wife. I told you, you won't find this in the Oscar stories. Bahavos Barate de Achose, and she was in fact his niece. Bahavos Bozis Le Kodom Talmidoy, and she used to abuse him in front of his pupils. A double wrong, to abuse him, number one, is bad. And to do it in public, three wrongs. To do it in public, and to do it in front of your pupils. Three times wrong. Amorin Talmidoi, his Talmidim used to say to him, Rebbe, Shavkol hadu intato visha delesa mikata. It doesn't befit you to remain married to a woman like this. Leave her, divorce her. Amalohun, he said to them, what do you think his answer was? Great Rabbi Yossi Haglili. I would love to, just don't have the money. You should see our ksuba, you should see our anti-nuptial contract. She'll take me to the cleaners. There's no way I can. One day he and Rabbi Loza ben Azari, look at these people, Rabbi Yossi Aglili and Rabbi Loza ben Azari, are busy learning, and they're discussing, and they're having a wonderful time. In the Haslin, when they finished, Amale said to him, Mashkach Rebbe Vanan Talkin Leveisa, come, let's go home and have something to eat. Amale said, great, let's go. Kisolik Amachat Leapa Unafakla. As they came to Rabbi Yossi Haglili's house, she walked out in a huff. She stamped out and disappeared. As she's walking from the house, Tzofa Bahai Kadeira, Amale, he saw a pot on the stove, and he said to her, she's walking out, is there anything in the pot? Is there anything here for lunch for us? I really need parparoy. And she says, oh, some burnt leftovers. I think nothing much. Azol galese. He goes to the pot and he lifts it up. For ashkach pargoyim, he finds the most delicious delicacies, especially cooked duck. Beautiful, beautifully done. Yeda Rabbi Loza ben Azariah mahu shema. Rabbi Loza ben Azariah understood. She didn't want him to eat the good duck, so she said there's just burnt leftovers there. She didn't want him to get any pleasure from what she had cooked. He understood. Yosven lo hanochlin, they sat and they ate. Omale, he said to him eventually, Rebbe, Lo Amrisel of Paparoim, didn't I hear her say that there was just some little bit of gravy in there, nothing much? Hoashkechon Begava Pargoim, look what we found, look how delicious. Omale, he said to her, Avdalika, he said to her, Masin Isinhein, God does miracles. Yeah, just turned into this duck, amazing. Quiet, they wait. Mindechasli in Omale, when they finished, he said, Rebbe, come, Rebbe, my teacher, Shavoki hoi into Tomino, please divorce this woman. Telesli hi avdachli korach, she doesn't befit you. That's what God wanted when he created this opportunity, that you have that ability to do that. He separated man and woman and made them into two beings who choose to be together. Daily. Surely you're not choosing every day to be with this woman? So he says the same story. He says, I can't afford it. Says Rabbi Lozab Nazari, Anan Yahavenon lo puno ushvayakas minach. Rebbe, whatever it costs, your students will carry the bill. Whatever it is, we'll raise the money. Just get rid of this woman. Avdun lekein. So they did that. Psaklo puno ushvak yosemine. He gave her a get and they paid her out. Vaspun yoseita to achro tavomino. And they married him off to a very nice woman. And he was fine, he was happy. Geramun choivin dahi itato. Vaslas vid nase bit lesantar de karta. But she was now going to be repaid for her sin. So she's now free from her first marriage, and she married also very quickly. She's married again to the guard of the city, the police chief, sheriff. Not a bad shidduch. After Rabbi Yossi Agili, she marries the sheriff. Leboso yomi atun yisun aloi v'isava. But the sheriff went blind. And in those days, there was no equal opportunity acts and laws like that. She's blind, you're fired. She can't see on the job. You're out. It's not our problem. So the sheriff is always sheriff. And she's always sheriff's wife. Nothing to do. I have a tayora bideu mechazre la shakikai de karta. Never, it was very sad. They had to go around begging. And she would lead him around so that he could use his previous status and position to appeal to people. And she would lead him through the streets. Kevan davas matio beshakikai de Rabbi Yossi Aglili. Have a kayomelo vechazre la achareo. But when they came anywhere near Rabbi Yossi Aglili's street, she would move away and go down another side so that she wouldn't go past that house. But he was the sheriff. He knew every little lane and every little street. He knew, he could figure out, even when he was blind, he knew exactly where she was going. Amalo, he said to her, why don't you take me to Rabbi Yossi Aglili's area? I hear that he's very charitable. Surely that's the place we should be going. Amalo, she says to him, apparently the first time, I am his divorcee and I just cannot face him. I don't want to go there. One day they came in that area and he felt, first day, the second day, he felt that she was pulling him away from there, and he started hitting her. They started fighting and arguing. The whole town started coming out, a big tumult. This blind man, the blind ex-sheriff and his wife are having a fight, and what's going on? Adik Rabbi Yossi Lekolon, Rabbi Yossi hears their voice. The Chamoyin, Mitbazon, Begoshuka, and he sees them fighting in the street. Omale, he says to them, Lamot Machile, why are you hitting him? What's this all about? Omale, he said to him, every day, we've got to raise money for ourselves, and she won't bring me here. She won't bring me to this part. Kevin the Shomer Rabbi Yossi came. What did Rabbi Yossi do? What was his response? He suffered from this woman for years and years. Finally, he divorces her. She lands up marrying the sheriff, and then her luck runs out, and she's on the street. What does he do? Nasbeihun v'yayil yosim b'chado beise min didei. He took one of his houses and gave it to them for nothing, and accommodated them, and supplied them with food, and with money, and with a home, kol yemei chayehem, for the rest of their lives. Why? That's what it means, umibsorcho al tis'alem. We're told in Tanakh, in Yeshayahu, don't ignore your own flesh. When it comes to charity, start at home. Start with the people who are closest to you. Start with the people you have a relationship with. And the Medrash is brought on this posuk because Bahoyu Lebosor Echod, they become one flesh. So yes, that contractual relationship can break, that marriage can break, but there's something there, there's a besolchod. That coming together is not like the animal world. It's true, as the Ramban says, they can come, they can choose to come, they can separate, they can choose to come. That's talking about the choice to live together. But once they have lived together, there is something. There is a bond that cannot, that needs to be recognized. And Rabbi Yossi Aglili recognizes her, his ex-wife, from whom he suffered so terribly, still as a sort of relative to whom he has a responsibility. And without any anger and without any malice whatever, brings them in and takes care of them in one of his houses so that they shouldn't have to worry. In that we see to some degree what the Torah means when it says V'hoyu lebosor echad. If that's the sense of responsibility after all those years of suffering and divorce and remarriage, where there's absolutely no relationship, no responsibility, no financial relationship, no legal relationship, no emotional relationship, what did they have together? But when human beings get together, man and wife, there's a bosor echod. There is a level of intimacy, there is a level of togetherness, which is so meaningful, which is so deep, that it's as it was almost before Adam and Chava were separated from being one being and were created into two beings. And so what is it that we see here? We see here a relationship between man and woman in the human species that is more, that is closer and more intimate than in any other species. We see a relationship that is in a sense even closer than it was before they were separated physically from one another. But the closest is the function not of being tied together by an unvoidable contract. The process is not one of being tied together by a physical togetherness that cannot be biologically separated. That it is possible for two human beings to tie themselves together in a relationship that is so tight, even though there's daily choice to be together. In fact, where that is the rhythm, where that is the flow and the ebb that D.H. Lawrence talks about and the Havdil, the Ramban talks about, the coming apart and choosing to come together, the degree of that intimacy, the degree of that togetherness is far greater than any permanence that people try to find security in. There is no permanence. There can only be permanence in the creation of desire, in the creation of a desire to be together. We see that in many areas. We see that in business. We see that there used to be a time where a business would create, would develop its customer security by creating in the customer the desire not to go anywhere else. There's just such a relationship. Remember the old days, the relationship with the banker, the relationship with the lawyer, the relationship with the little supermarket on the corner before there were the big impersonal ones. It didn't matter if things were a little cheaper around the corner. It didn't matter if you could. You didn't go into the internet to see where you could find the cheapest. You knew your guy would kind of take care of you and you wanted him to have a living as well, but there was a relationship. And unless something really happened to sever that relationship, you wanted to keep the relationship and he worked at it and you worked at it. And the supplier, the businessman, worked on those relationships. So that there should be in the customer the daily choice to want to stay. The daily choice not to be anywhere else. That's the greatest security, because what competitor can possibly get into that relationship where there's a daily choice to want to stay together? Today it's entrapment. Today it's trapping a customer into loyalty through loyalty programs and bribery and frequent flyer options, where it just doesn't pay you to move. Not because you love where you are, not because you have a relationship, you're caught, you're trapped. And there's a shift in business from finding security through attracting people into finding security by entrapping people. And we have that in all relationships. And when a relationship gets insecure, the first thing we try to do is to entrap and to kidnap and to hold. That's not what the Ribbono Shel Olam wanted. He wanted the human being to use his capacity to create attractiveness, to create desire, to create want, and to create choice. And in that the human being finds security, in that the human being finds intimacy. That does bring us to the end of creation. because now we've got woman created too as a separate being, as an independent being, as an equal being, an intimacy between man and woman created, and that does conclude the act of creation other than the sin itself, the first sin, which actually also forms part of creation, because at the end of the day that happened also on the sixth day before Shabbat.